Thank you very much, Per. Good morning, everyone. Thank you for inviting me here. I will try to talk a little bit about hydrotreating catalysis. And that means why am I doing that? That's because I'm working with the refinery section in R&D, where I'm the vice president. And there we have seen that, of course, in the future that a lot of the growth within the refinery area will be in Asia, and therefore it's important for us to have a strong partnership here in Asia, especially here in China. I will try to talk about how you go from molecular understanding of the reaction pathways and support interactions to improved industrial solutions, so you get the entire story from nanotechnology all the way up to upscale the technology. I hope you will enjoy it. Let me just jump right into it by showing you a hydrotreating reactor. Here we have a hydrotreating catalyst in the reactor. We have a feed going in, straight run light gas oil, going in with a 1.3 weight percent of sulfur, and when you analyze the feed with a GC by GC, then you'll get all your sulfur compounds, all the types of sulfur compounds from your feed. It is still difficult to quantify the exact amount of each of them, but what we can do is try to begin and hydrotreat, and then after the first 5% of the reactor, what we'll see is that we'll actually already be down to around 2,000 ppm, and all the thiophenes and benzothiophenes have been removed from the feedstock, leaving us down to 2,000 ppm of sulfur. Going 5% further down, is 10% down in the reactor, we're already down to 800 ppm of sulfur. And now we have even less sulfur compounds left. Almost all of the dibenzothiophenes, I'll show you how dibenzothiophene looks in a little bit. But the point is that the most refractory compounds, where you have positioned in 416, you will actually see that those are the most difficult to remove. They are still left after the first 10%. And when you get down to one-third of the reactor, what you will see is you'll only be left with one type of compound, sulfur compounds, and that is the 4,6 alkyl substituted dibenzothiophenes. So you can see that most of the reactor, two-thirds of the reactor, is used to remove one type of sulfur compounds in order for us to get down to the wished 10 ppm 10 ppm of sulfur in the final product, which is needed for trucks when they're driving in the large cities. Now let's look at what this is the 4,6 alkyl substituted dibenzothiophenes. That is the 4,6 DMDBT dimethyl dibenzothiophene. This is the most refractory compound, the one with the lowest reactivity. And when you follow the desulfurization of that, it can actually follow two routes. It can go the direct route, where you do a carbon sulfur hydrogenolysis, and you actually use less hydrogen when you remove the sulfur here compared to when you go the hydrogenation route, where you actually need to saturate one of the rings, the aromatic rings, before you will end up with the final product where one of the saturated rings is saturated, one of the rings is saturated and the sulfur is removed. And the question you can ask here, first of all, is, well, are both routes important in order to remove the sulfur? And secondly is, well, how does it look on when you zoom in on the active side? What happens on the active side? Are we able to say something about that? And that I will try to go into. In the second part of my talk, I will also go into some renewable diesel in the second part. What I can say is, is it important? As you can see, we have the dibenzothiophenes. You have a very high reactivity, and that's what you saw, is that dibenzothiophenes were easily removed in the top of the reactor. But when you added in a refractory compound at position 4, as 4-methyl dibenzothiophenes, then the direct route desulfurization decreased a lot. The hydrogenation route, it still has to go on top of the slide. You'll still have the same reactivity. And then when you have alkyl or methyl compound on each of the 4 and 6 position, let me just go back. The 4 and 6 position are these 4 and 6 position. Then the reactivity drops dramatically for the DMDBT on the direct route, and on the hydrogenation route we still have a pretty high reactivity. But what you have to bear in mind here is that these results are only for when you don't have any inhibition of nitrogen, and I'll get back to that later in the speech. So it is important to have an understanding of both the hydrogenation route and the direct desulfurization route when trying to understand what happens in a hydrotreating reactor producing ultra-low sulfur diesel. Now let's go into the nature of the sites. In the early 80s, the type 2 structures were discovered, and what actually was discovered was when looking at the direct desulfurization route, you actually found that there were two different types of activities when promoted with cobalt. So you had the one which type 1, which were the one which were linked or heavily linked to the support, and you had the two type 2 comas, which was less heavily linked to the support, and that gave a difference in the activity, huge difference. And then, how do I know whether you're linked or not to the support? I'll try to show you that in the coming slides. That's actually the difference between type 1 and type 2. This is let me just explain. This is a molybdenum disulfide. Blue is molybdenum, sulfur is yellow. And then you have done density functional theory calculations, or DFT studies, on where does how does this molybdenum disulfide, how will it like to link to a support? And when you look at that, you have different possibilities. You can either link it to the moly edge or the sulfur edge. And what you will find out is that the lowest energy used, or actually gained, is when you have the linkage to the sulfur edge. So you're strongly favored to have the molybdenum disulfide linked to the support via the sulfur edge because of this low energy state here. Now, the interesting thing is that when you then do other observation with scanning tunneling microscopy on a COMO nanocrystal, then you'll actually see that here you have your COMO crystal. You'll actually see that that the edges here where the sulfur was supposed to be on a molybdenum disulfide is actually fully substituted by cobalt instead. So, and if we do density functional theory calculations again, or XSAFS measurements, then you'll find out that is actually correct. That's a correct observation that we do in STM here. So what you can see is that your cobalt wants to be substituted in the sulfur edge, and at the same time, the molybdenum disulfide, or the nanocrystals here, they want to be linked to the support. So the cobalt is competing with the linkage to the support. And this is actually the difference between type 1 and type 2, because we know that the sulfur vacancies, I'll show you in a second, actually come from promoting with the cobalt. And when you get sulfur vacancies, then you get a lot of direct route desulfurization activity. Let me show you the vacancy in the sulfur edge. There you can do DFT studies as well. Now, if you have a linkage of your sulfide to the support, then you'll see you need a lot of energy in order to create a vacancy of sulfur. If you need a lot of energy, then you will create less vacancies. So type 1, which are the one which you have sites, which are the one which I have been linked to the support, are actually not creating a lot of vacancies, and therefore you will get this lower activity, as opposed to if you have a sulfur edge which is not linked to the support, then you will need less energy in order to create this vacancy. Now, just to say, what is the support? That's alumina, and I just wanted to show you that we also look into the alumina very much in order to optimize our catalysts. We need to understand what is happening in the interface between the COMOS sites and the alumina. And these are the alumina agglomerates. These are the precipitation agglomerates, and this is a zoom in on an alumina crystal on a nanoscale. Now, I've talked about the direct desulfurization sites, which are the type 1 and type 2 sites, where we would like the type 2 because they create the vacancy. But there were the hydrogenation route as well. And what we can see here is that the brim sites are the one which are doing the hydrogenation. And the brim, this is the brim sites, and it's called the brim because on the brim of a molybdenum disulfide or a COMOS nanocrystal, you will have a lot of dissociated hydrogen, and you can actually get the sulfur compounds to adsorb on the surface. And actually, what we have done here is made STM observation of a molybdenum disulfide in a hydrogen atmosphere, and then we had thiophene adsorbed on the surface. And when it adsorbs, it actually creates this cis-but-2-ene thiolate, meaning that you have the sulfur adsorbing on the edge, on the brim sides, together with the metal. And actually, when we did this observation, we needed to confirm whether that was correct from the STM, and when we do DFT calculation, we will actually see that we have the same adsorbate on the surface of thiophene. So we believe this is what happens. Now, the sites are not always triangular. What you will see is that when you start promoting, you will get a different shape of your structure, of your COMOS structure, where you have the cobalt fully substituted on the sulfur edges here, and you maybe have some inclusion of cobalt in the molybdenum disulfide as well. Of course, the size of this also matters on how many hydrogenation sites, how many brim sites you will get. And how much copper cobalt you use will always also depend on how much sulfur vacancies that you will get. Well, the way that you sulfide your originally oxidic catalyst, cobalt molybdenum oxides, also matters. Here you can see a study on how, if you have a very high H2S to hydrogen ratio, then you'll get triangular triangular comas, and if you sulfide it in a very low with a very low amount of H2S, then you get this hexagonal. And finally, the support also matters in terms of what type of shape you'll get of your comas. So all in all, you can see that I wanted to visualize you have two types of sites. You have, this is 4,6 dimethyl dibenzothiophene. And as you can see here, this is your comas site. You will have your 4,6 DMDBT if it goes on the brim site, where you had a lot of hydrogenation activity. Then it will adsorb, not going down like this, but actually going down like this on the surface. And then it will start hydrogenate one of the aromatic rings here, and then it will capture the sulfur and then desorbs without the sulfur. Whereas the direct desulfurization site, there you can see you need a sulfur vacancy in order for the sulfur to get in and be desulfurized. And as I just showed you, you rather need the type 2 sites where you're not linked to the alumina or the support. Then you will have more sulfur vacancies, and then you'll get higher desulfurization activity. Let me just show you an animation, and I hope this works, of how thiophene actually is desulfurized on a comas surface. You have it adsorbs. It has dissociated hydrogen, which then is added to the, which is then used from the surface. Let me show you once more. Adsorbed, use the hydrogen dissociated on the surface. Then it can actually adsorb as this cis-butene thiolate, and then it will desorb when the sulfur is captured with another hydrogen, then you have the H2S, and then it can actually desorb the desulfurized thiophene. Now, that was on a nanoscale part where we actually saw what happens on the surfaces. The interesting thing is that when you start doing desulfurization, then you find out that a lot of nitrogen compounds will actually start to inhibit your reaction. So you'll see that when you have a lot of nitrogen in your feedstocks, then you actually see a large decline in activity of your catalyst. So what we did was, in a more upscaled manner, we did some pilot plant tests. First of all, we took one of our standard feedstocks, which is a blend of straight run gas oil and light cycle oil. And there we have around 300 ppm of nitrogen. And if we just run with I think it's a space velocity of 2.5 or something like that, then you'll actually, at low pressure, then you'll end up having around 800 ppm of sulfur in the product. And now you ask, well, why are we running at 800 ppm? That's going to show in the coming. Because then what we did was took the feedstock, and then on a silica column, you can actually extract all of the nitrogen compounds out of the feedstock. So we removed all the nitrogen compounds from the feedstock. That is... Then we have a feedstock with all the sulfur, but no nitrogen, literally. And then we added back 300 ppm of nitrogen in form of 1,4 dimethyl carbazole. So this is the corresponding to the DMDBT, sterically hindered. So maybe this is this we can see that the nitrogen will actually inhibits the desulfurization. When we did the results, what we saw was that, well, you get a better desulfurization, you get lower sulfur in your product, and therefore you get a better desulfurization. So the inhibition of the carbazole here is lower than the normal nitrogen that you have in your feedstock. We did the same with 3-methyl indole, and what we saw here is that indole does not inhibit the desulfurization very much, at least lower compared to the nitrogen in the original feedstock. Then we added in acridine, and acridine is a basic nitrogen, and what happened was that we saw a lot of inhibition, so the sulfur in the product actually increased compared to when looking at the original feedstock. And in the final study, what we did was take these feedstock without the nitrogen in, and then we added in 100 ppm of acridine, 100 ppm of the indole, and 100 ppm of the carbazole. And then we got a result that actually looks very much like a linear combination of the inhibition of these three. So this looks very intuitively correctly. So now, what is it that happens? It seems like we have a large inhibition of acridine. So maybe acridine is very difficult to remove. Let's look at that a little bit further. We had what we did was take the same feedstock where you don't have the original feedstock, no nitrogen is removed, no silica treatment. And then we ran with two different space velocity, 2.5 and 1.5, I think. And then we had this removal of nitrogen, down to 40% removal of the overall, and down to 30 or 20 something removal of the nitrogen that is now. Then what we did was take the look at the other parts where we took the nitrogen-free feedstock, added in the indole, and then ran the experiment as you just saw. And what we see is that after 0.4 space time or space velocity 2.5, we can see that all the indole is removed from the feedstock. Look at the carbazole. That is this one. Then what we can see here is that almost all of it is removed after space velocity 2.5. And if we go to acridine, you can see that. Oh, sorry. You can see that that you have less of it removed after space velocity 2.5. So meaning that you can understand that you will have a larger inhibition of acridine here. And at space velocity 1.5, you'll see that almost all of the nitrogen is removed and not inhibiting the desulfurization anymore. And if you look at the mix of that, that was 100 ppm of each of these, you'll end up having a little bit less of nitrogen, which is a little surprising when you're down at space velocity 2.5 in the reactor. Now, if you take the same experiment, these are the same results. Now, one would imagine, well, if you look at the mix, what is left of what is the nitrogen left in the mix? It's very interesting to see that the indole has been removed from the mix. So this result that we are looking at. We look at the nitrogen compounds. What type of nitrogen compounds are left in the reactor after space velocity 2.5? We can see we have almost no indole left. We have a lot of carbazoles left. That is actually an interesting result, because it was acridine which we saw was inhibiting the reactions. And how much acridine is then left? What we see is that we almost have the zero acridine left when you're down there. So what happens actually here, which is an interesting part, is that actually it's the most difficult to remove is the carbazole, but the ones which inhibits the reactions the most is the acridine or the basic nitrogen compounds. So what happens is that on the surface of these COMOS sites that I showed you earlier, you will actually see that acridine always adsorbs first, so it wins the competition.